Yeah, my name is Vajra Jyoti, and I'm giving this talk as the last in a series of talks on wisdom. So if you've missed those other talks, I'll do a little bit of a recap and then just carry on from there. But I wanted to, I had this experience the other morning. It was a couple of weeks ago, one of the nights I was sleeping really, really badly, and I woke up extremely early and turned on the radio and heard about the Hadron Collider, which maybe some of you know more about than I do, but which is hardly anything. Anyway, it's the largest machine in the world, this Hadron Collider, and it's the world's most powerful particle collider. It's is situated in a 27-kilometer tunnel, which runs under the French and Swiss border. Yeah, and there's a huge laboratory and stuff on top of it, which does a whole lot of stuff with the particle collisions. The collider propels particles beyond the speed of light, and then they collide into each other. And the scientists or physicists or whoever analyse what happens after the collisions. And apparently, according to the radio program, in this way they get a better understanding of the fundamental laws of nature. When I wake up extremely early in the morning and turn on the radio, it's because I'm hoping there'll be something very, very boring on and I'll just go straight back to sleep. But it was really, really interesting. And I was kind of struck by this idea of this 27-kilometre tunnel under the French-Swiss border and all this, and the particles colliding with each other. And it got me also, because at the time I was also thinking about this talk, which is about the nature of reality, and it got me thinking about different ways of understanding the nature of reality. From Gautama, the Buddha, meditating under a tree in India 2,500 years ago, to scientists now in Europe colliding particles together, all with the same sort of goal, to understand how reality or how the universe works. So that's what I'm talking about tonight. It's two kind of approaches, two reflective approaches to understanding how reality works, two Buddhist approaches to understanding the true nature of things. So I'll just recap the series. It's not that it's that important, but there's been a bit of a progression. So Ratnavyuha began a while ago, weeks and weeks ago now, on the night that marked the Buddha's passing away, or Parinirvana. And he was talking briefly, actually, then about reflecting on impermanence as a way to go to understand more deeply reality. And then Sujiva was next, I'm pretty sure, and he amongst other things, he talked about three levels of wisdom and how we can progress through them by studying the Dharma. That's one level of wisdom, reflecting on what we've studied and meditating deeply on the essence of what we studied. The following week, Guhyasiddhi, he explored the use of myth and symbol. And I don't know if you remember, he had those of you who are here, he had this amazing symbol, actually. He had a big round mirror in the middle of the room with lotuses and other things kind of floating on it. It was very gorgeous. Blue cloth. And he described various episodes from the Buddha's life and showed how myth and symbol and poetry could help us intuit more deeply into the true nature of things. And Erica, who's here, she built on his talk by exploring how devotional practices, specifically our sevenfold puja, could engage the depths of our beings, the depths to which reason cannot penetrate, really. So we can in that way build or develop, I guess, an emotional understanding of what we can quite easily figure out with our rational minds, but it's only when those understandings penetrate to the very depths that we are transformed by them. And then last week, our lovely visitor, Amalavajra, was here, and he was talking about money, and he quite cunningly kind of wove it into the wisdom theme by talking about the emptiness of money. in helping us explore our habitual ways of being with money. So my job tonight is to bring that theme of wisdom, the whole theme's wisdom, to bring that to a close. And I can't remember the brief really, but what I'm doing is talking about two particular reflective or contemplative practices. Excuse me. In which we, they're two different approaches really to analysing the nature of phenomena, and to the point that we can see that there's nothing essential in phenomena. And that sounds like a bit of a riddle really, but I'll talk around it from a few different angles, and maybe it will become clearer what I'm talking about. So there's two. I mean, there's many, many approaches, like the ones that the previous speakers have been talking about. But the two I'm talking about, one analyses things into their components, into their bits. So a bit like, I was thinking about the periodic table, which I used to love at school. I don't know why, I really love the periodic table and all the little symbols and stuff. And so early chemists, I suppose, identified and isolated chemical elements and put them all on the periodic table, and so maybe they found there's iron and there's gold and there's oxygen. And then of course you can go further into iron or gold or oxygen, and it's not a single entity. There's it's made up of components. I'm not a chemist or a physicist, but maybe electrons, protons, neutrons, and then further on subatomic particles. So it's that approach of looking at anything and breaking it into ever smaller bits. And that's one of, that kind of sounds boring, probably, but that's one approach to practice, is analysing things that are important to us, actually. That's what makes it more interesting. Into their component parts and so on, increasingly small component parts, until you realise there's actually nothing at their core, nothing at their essence. And the other approach that I'm going to talk about tonight, it's coming from a different angle, and that you might look at the same things or things that are precious to us, but you're looking at the processes that make them up rather than the bits. And I'm reminded of that question that's quoted quite a bit for apparently scientists. When they're looking at light, they, depending on the way they look at it, it's either a particle or a wave. So I think that the approach of analysing things into their component bits is probably the particle approach. If you look at light in a certain way, you see particles. And the approach of looking at the processes that make up things is, you'd see a wave, you'd see light as a wave. So they're two particular, quite different, but with contemplative practices that bring one to the same place. And you might think, well, so what? Why? Why is that? What's that got to do with Buddhism? What's that got to do with me? And the answer is really that the more we can not just understand, but really emotionally understand the way things actually are, the way phenomena actually is, the more we can live in accordance with it. And as a result, the more we can be in alignment with reality, and therefore there won't be such of a rub. The suffering in life comes from leading our lives at odds, really, with how things really are. If we fully understand in our hearts and minds how things really are, we will live in accordance with reality, and therefore there will be less kind of rub between our wants and aversions and reality, and we will just live in accordance with it, and therefore no suffering. And that was the Buddha's mission, really. He wasn't interested in physics or chemistry or particles. He was interested in suffering and the end of suffering. And that's really what these practices are about. They're about the end of suffering. So if they sound dull, apologies, that's my fault. They aren't dull practices at all. They're very engaging practices. And hopefully I'll communicate a little bit of that. I'm going to start with the first practice, the kind of analytical practice, quite briefly, and then I'll talk about the other one more fully, the process-oriented one. And then we'll have a very short tea break, and then after the tea break, I'll lead a practice in the shrine room. So the first approach, I'm just giving an example of it, really. There's lots of different contemplative practices that analyse things into their bits ad infinitum. This particular one uses a formulation that you might have come across in the Heart Sutra, which is the sutra that we recite in the Sevenfold Puja. I'll just quote a bit of it, which might ring a bell. So we say, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself, are the same as this. So in the sutra we're listing form, feeling, thought, choice and consciousness. And those are particular translations of the original, well, not even Pali words, pre-Pali words, but of the original words. So form, feeling, thought, choice and consciousness. And those five, well, they're called skandhas. Skandhas literally means heaps. Anyway, those five skandhas are ways of describing or categorising everything that makes up our experience. So form is the human body. Yeah? And the other four are basically our mental and emotional experiences. So by reflecting on these five skandhas, we're reflecting on the whole of our experience, really, on everything that it means to be human. So we reflect on them with using our imagination. It's a very active practice. It's not like sitting there trying to have a calm, clear mind. It's a very active, contemplative practice. So, for example, with the first one, form, that's this thing, the body. We can reflect on the body. Just what we might do right now is think about our bodies. Most of us have two arms, two legs, two eyes, two ears, one head. We can reflect on those kind of parts. We can reflect, oh, if I didn't have two arms and two legs, would I still be me? Would I still have a body? If I didn't have two arms, two legs and a head, would I still be me? You know, we can start breaking our body down in that way. But we can also reflect on the bits that aren't so apparent to us, that we need our imagination to bring to mind. So one liver, most of us have one liver, one heart, you know, kidneys, two, I think, that kind of thing. We can reflect on our organs, one spinal column, maybe. I'm not obviously very knowledgeable about bodies, but bones, I don't know how many bones, lots of bones. We can reflect on all those things and kind of feel them in, to some degree. We might have a sense of our stomach, say, or our heart, but we need our imagination too to do that reflection. And as we sit quietly with that, I mean, I'm not being at all quiet about it now, but in our own minds we can be quite quiet and still in that kind of reflection and bring our bodies and the limbs and organs to mind and begin to understand that this body that we might be, you know, we might be proud of our bodies or embarrassed about our bodies, or we might make a project out of our bodies by going to the gym, or, you know, we've all got things going on with our bodies or with bits of our bodies. Anyway, we begin to understand that this body is just a collection of parts. And some parts we're very aware of, our hands, say, or our arms or legs or feet, and some parts we aren't so aware of. And just by using words get in the way a bit, because even using the word parts suggests that they're substantial parts. They're not. You can analyse them down and down and down to cells, nuclei, I don't know, subatomic particles, and that's all our bodies are made of, as far as our imagination can take us, really, in terms of breaking the parts down into ever smaller bits. And then you can start to ask yourself, well, when does it stop being a body? When does it become a collection of subatomic particles, say? And that might all sound a bit analytical and dire, really. But it's not. In fact, it's very, very freeing. That skanda, the body form, and all the other skandas, when you analyse them deeply, a sense of freedom and relief and release emerges, because we are often unknowingly very tightly grasping to our ideas about ourselves. So I'll just give a quick example with one of the other skandhas, which is feeling. It's which is a not great translation of the word vedana, which some of you would have come across. So remember I said form, feeling, thought, choice, consciousness. So feeling's the second one. So vedana is feeling in the sense of just bare feeling, bare sensation. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's not like moods or emotions. It's not complex at all in that way. It's just bare sensation, bare feeling. So we might start, and often we do this in meditation, or when I'm leading a meditation, I suggest that people look for pleasant vedana. So now, sitting here, you might look for pleasant vedana, which might be, what might it be? A nice sense of coolness on the skin, maybe. Tingling in the face can be quite pleasant vedana. It's not complex, it's just a kind of pleasant feeling. It reminds us we're alive. We might look for unpleasant vedana, maybe our clothes are a bit tight, or something, a part of our body is a bit cold, or we've got a sense of tightness in our head, you know. So we might do a reflection like that, just identifying, almost labelling pleasant and unpleasant vedana. And then we would look for neutral vedana, which is a bit harder to spot. The neutral vedana really means everything we don't notice it easily. It's a vedana that's not apparent, not easily apparent. It's like boring vedana. An example for me, maybe not for all of you, is the tops of your thighs. Is it pleasant? Is the sensation in the tops of your thighs pleasant or unpleasant? It might be obvious it's one or the other. For me, it's neutral. Not much to notice, really. Nothing that grabs my attention. But interestingly, with neutral vedana, the more time you spend with it, the more unpleasant or pleasant it gets. Yeah? That's the trouble with this. Sensations become more highlighted. And some things that you thought were neutral turn out to be unpleasant. But on the other hand, things that you thought were neutral turn out to be pleasant as well. And then the whole point of this is, the longer we stay with vedana, is the more we realise that sensation is just sensation, right? There's nothing more to it. There's no me in there. There's no my neutral vedana thighs or my pleasant vedana tingly face. It's just sensation. And as a result, we start to loosen up our identification with it. And again, it's very pleasurable, actually. There's a sense of letting go in that loosening up of identification. There's a real relief, an openness, and a sense of increased creativity and possibility in that. So that's the analytical approach, the particle approach. I want to spend more time on another practice, which is more like it's about process rather than component parts. I think it's the wave approach. It's how I'm thinking of it. So it's about processes is probably the best way of putting it. And it's one that we do more in Tibetan, actually, this particular practice. It emphasises, it's called the six element practice, and I'm going to just introduce a simplified version of it tonight. And it emphasises that nothing lives or moves under its own volition, under its own power, and that every thing that arises is based on many conditions or processes. So nothing stands alone, really. Everything is a process and is arises on the basis of other processes. Even a mountain, even a tabletop, even a chair, everything is a collection of processes which is based or dependent on other processes. So this sixth element practice, it's a very profound contemplation of the kind of fundamental teaching of the Buddha of interconnectedness, or sometimes we call that Paticca Samuppada, that all things are connected, and of impermanence, another fundamental Buddhist teaching, and insubstantiality. And this sixth element practice is described many times in the earliest Buddhist writings, suggesting that it was done, well, that it was perhaps common is not the right word, but a practice used a lot, even from the earliest times of the Buddha's disciples. And in this practice, like in the other one, we had the skandhas. In this practice, we use the elements, which takes a bit of explaining. So the elements are earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. So that's just a kind of a set of categories, like the skandhas. It's another set of categories. It refers to everything that we think of as us and everything that we think of as outside of us. I mean, in a way, you could use any set of categories. You could use a periodic table, actually. But there's many more to them, of course. The six elements have an advantage of being, well, the way I see it, both very practical in that they're pragmatic in a way. They're available to us in the reflection. And they're also poetic and evocative. So there's a particular a way in which the six elements engage the imagination and the heart by their very nature. So they don't just engage the head, the analytical head. They engage they potentially engage all of your being. And as we reflect on these elements, we go through all six. In the formal practice, we go through all six, and we notice how each of them is an ever-changing process, not a static thing. I'll say more about each of them so you get a kind of a feel for them. And we realise that this entity, I call me, this body, this cognition, the set of cognitions, the set of emotional responses, is just process. It's just process. It's not me, Vajrajyoti. It's just a set of processes which is dependent on a multiplicity of other processes. And the practice magically. It's not magic, though. It just does. It leads to a profound sense of letting go, an open-hearted contentment, an open-hearted sense of generosity and creativity, and a real a knowing of our interconnectedness with all other beings and with everything else in the universe, not just people or animals, but rocks, trees, everything. Just a kind of a health warning, maybe. I'll lead the practice later, and it will be a simplified version because it is a profound practice, and we normally teach it in quite specific retreat conditions to people who already have a solid meditation practice, already have a strong sense of being part of this community, so who are well supported, and who have through their meditation practice and their ethical practice, an ability to be quite fluid with their positive emotion, with their mental states. It's profoundly challenging in a way. That's what I'm trying to say. And you need to be well supported personally to engage with the profundity of the practice. And talking about the practice, I'm drawing on a book that I actually meant to bring. It's Bodhi Paksha's book, which might be here. Living as a River. Is it up there, Erica? No. Anyway, I just want to give him the credit. He's written this lovely book called Living as a River, which I've studied a few times with different groups of people. And he explores the practice in a lot of, I was going to say detail, but it's not detail, it's just really, really interesting the way he explores it. So I'm just turning over because there's a couple of paragraphs just going on and on about the practice and how wonderful it is. But I think I've kind of done that. I might come back to that. So what I want to do is explain what the elements are, really, because it sounds obvious, but it's not. They're, the words are kind of quite a poetic way of suggesting what the qualities are. So each category, earth, water, fire, air, space, consciousness, is referring to a particular quality rather than a thing, rather than anything substantial. For example, the earth element is not literally the earth, and it's not things that grow out of the earth. It's not things that are nourished by the earth. It is things that have the quality of earthiness, which is a quality of solidity or resistance, like skin, has the quality of the earth element. If you touch your skin, there's a resistant quality to it. Tabletops, naturally. Anything with a resistant or solid quality comes under the category of earth element. Could be teeth, could be bones, could be cars, could be computers, could be satellites, you know, anything kind of hard and resistant. So it takes a bit of a shift because we think of the, you know, Mother Earth and all those associations with the earth. It's not quite like that. So in the first stage of the practice, I will lead it later, but it's worth engaging with now, really, I think. We recollect everything or anything that is solid or resistant that has that earthy quality within us. And we may need to use our imaginations to do that, like sitting here, I can feel my teeth, I can feel my skin, I can maybe feel my skeleton, kind of. I can feel, yeah, some bits of skeleton, like ribcage maybe. You know, we can feel the earth element in that particular way, through actual sensation, through a tactile quality, but we also use our imaginations and engage with the earth element imaginatively. So I don't know if you can feel your toenails. I can't feel my toenails, but I know I have them. I can bring to mind toenails. I can bring to mind fingernails. I can bring to mind, as I said before, the organs. The organs are kind of a mixture of earth and water, I think. You know, they're kind of solid, kind of fluid. So, but we can bring to mind all the, not all because it will take too long, but parts of our body that are kind of earthy, resistant, solid. So each stage of this practice has a particular kind of format. So we start off with the element within us. So in this example, the earth element within us, earthiness, the earthy quality in us. And then we extend to the earthy quality around us. So seat on our seat, our bum on seat, obvious starting place, feet on floor. It's kind of our earthiness meeting the earthiness outside of us, right? And then we extend more widely. We might, this is in the meditation itself, but it's an imaginative practice. We bring to mind perhaps the walls of the building, the streets of the city. I'm trying to think of all the hard things, that we might bring to mind: trees, other people, the earthiness of them, mountains, rocks. So much earthiness out there. There's so much to engage with imaginatively, and it's a practice that really repays that kind of imaginative engagement. it creates a sense of spaciousness. If you imagine all the earthy elements in the world, you know, the great deserts, the great mountains, great cities even, animals, people, vast forests, there's all that kind of earthiness, all that earth quality. So we're engaging, you know, internally, externally with the earth element, actually either through sensation or through our imagination. And then we reflect on how the earthiness that makes us up got to be us, if you know what I mean. How did we get those bones, those teeth, those fingernails, those toenails, that skull, you know? And obviously, it's only through taking in earth element from outside. It's only through earth element coming in and passing through us and some of it hanging around for a while that this thing I call me, is here. And the process continues. Even as I speak, bits of hair are falling out, bits of skin, I hate to tell you, bits of skin are falling off. You do not trust me. our bones are, what are they doing? Dissolving and being recreated as I speak. Earth element is making itself all the time within our bodies and all around us. Trees are growing, mountains are eroding, you know, so on. And a lovely example that Bodhi Paksha uses in that book I forgot to bring, he suggests we reflect on our conception. You know, two cells came together at our conception and your conception. Two cells came together, formed an embryo. The embryo was nourished by your mother through food, as a result of food that and liquid that she ingested. And the embryo grew and became a baby that became you. There was nothing inherently you to start with. There was nothing there before the two cells came together. There was nothing, there was no you-ness. The you-ness, that what you think of as you or me, came later, actually, much later, in, I don't know when, babyhood, early childhood. But it was just the coming together of cells, the feeding, the nourishing of those cells, the food that the mother ingested, and so on, the food that we've ingested, the earth element that we've taken in over our entire lives to this point that has created this body. There's nothing inherently you or me in that. It's just a process of, passing through, really. And a metaphor that Bodhi Paksha uses a lot is of a river. It's like everything comes and goes just like a river, including the earth element in the body and all the other elements. So that's just a bit of a fuller description of the earth element. I'm going to go through each of them because I've got time. But we reflect on the other physical elements, at least, in the same way. And with each one, actually, we reflect. There's a kind of phrase that we use. And I don't know, maybe people come up with their own phrases that are more evocative for them, but the standard phrase is, say, with the earth element, this is not me, this is not mine, I am not this. So it's a kind of a reflection we drop into the practice. So this earth element, it's not me, it's not mine, I don't own it, and it's not I am not this. So from earth we progress to earth water. And again, it's not literally water, it's the quality of wateriness, the quality of fluidity that we're reflecting on. But in a way, it's water is so watery, you know, and so much of our bodies are water, 60% according to Wikipedia, which must be right. So in terms of our bodies, we start reflecting on the wateriness in our bodies. Saliva, we can feel. We might feel a kind of wateriness in our eyes, maybe. We know we've got a lot of blood in our bodies, so we can imaginatively connect with blood, with mucus, with the wateriness in every cell of the body, the water in joints, lymph, all those other watery bits in our bodies, in our muscles. So we kind of directly or through our imagination connect with the water element in our bodies, and then we do the same with the water external to us. Water that we just, you know, is in our glass, if I only had one. Water in the pipes under the building. We might recollect the water in Oakley Creek, all the streams running down into the harbour, the great oceans, the great rivers, the great lakes, the water in the air, the water in the sky, the water under the earth, all the wateriness in the world. I mean, I'm saying water because it's easy, but all the other fluid stuff as well. It's the fluidity that we're connecting with the water element. And then we reflect that all the wateriness in us came from outside and is going to outside all the time. Going, you know, we're drinking, we're sweating, we're peeing, we're whatever else we're doing with wateriness. It's coming and going, and if it's only the flow of it that we wouldn't be alive if it wasn't coming and going all the time. We cannot hang on to it. It's not, so again, this is not me, this is not mine, I am not this. This blood is actually not mine. It's coming and going all the time. I just want to really reiterate, because I'm concerned I'm sounding quite like it's a very analytical practice. It's actually not. There's a deep sense of relief and freedom as we work our way through the elements like this. With each one, there's a sense of letting go often in the practice. So next is a fire element, and I want to quote from the Buddha here. Just different teachers actually talk about the fire element in different ways, but I'm relying on Bodhi Paksha, who quotes the Buddha as saying, fire element is that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, that by which what is eaten gets completely digested. So in other words, Bodhi Paksha says the fire element is our metabolism. I think of it as energy, actually. It's the energy within us and the energy of the world. So when I'm doing the practice, it's that, for me, it's that feeling of aliveness, the tingliness. I think of what I would feel if I was dead, which is a silly thing to think about because I wouldn't know, but I imagine all this tingling that we just take for granted is only there because of the fire element. You know, that's how we know we're alive. And if a part of our body is numb for quite a long period, I mean, a friend of mine actually she has a condition where her legs get numb. She can still use them, but she can't feel them. And it's deeply disconcerting not having that sense of aliveness in her legs. So I think that it's the fire element. That's the fire element, that metabolism that we're feeling all the time and taking for granted. Outside of us, the sun is the starting point, the heat of the sun, but it's all the other heat sources, actually, which all ultimately derive from the sun. So you could say it's the heat stored in the earth, in fossil fuels, in, hot pools, volcanoes, that kind of thing. It's the heat in a cup of tea. It's the heat that comes out of the hot tap. It's heat. It's the energy of heat. Oh, it's also the energy in food. I mean, the elements obviously kind of, they're not demarcated strictly. They merge. But the energy of food is what we metabolize, so that in a way is fire element. The air element is more straightforward. It's actually literally air. It's what we breathe. It's in us. It's always in us. It's always around us. And in the practice, we connect with the earth element. As soon as we connect with the air element, we're aware of that. We're aware of our breath. We're aware of our breath coming from outside, coming inside, and going back to outside. We're immediately aware of that flow, and we immediately know that it cannot be stopped, that we're only alive because of that flow of air. We cannot hang on to air element. That's the point of this practice. You cannot hang on to any of the elements. at that, in this point in the practice, often there's a kind of a turning point, I think, because it's so obvious that the air element is impermanent, transient, and it's not mine. I guess air element is always kind of also kind of the gaseous nature of our body. I guess there's oxygen and carbon dioxide and stuff flowing through our body. It's also that air, but that air, that's also the air element. That air element is also coming and going. It's never fixed. It's not mine. It's not me. I can't hang on to it. So earth, water, fire, air. Those are the four kind of physical elements. And as we engage with the practice, we get often, I think, a sense of wonder about this, about ourselves, about what makes us up, and about the world we live in. There's sometimes at least a deep sense of really getting that the nature of things is much more mysterious than we normally think, that our labels that we put on things, on the body, the breath, are just labels, that the labels are only very inadequate pointers to how things really are. And we also begin to realise that what we think of as in here and out there are not actually separate. There is no in here, just as there's no out there. They cannot be separated. And that's, as I keep reiterating, a great relief. Partly because actually I think the way we generally see ourselves in the world is that we're quite small. We're small, constrained, restricted and inadequate. And this practice really challenges that sense of our smallness. It reminds us again and again that there's actually not a me to be small. There's just a vast network of conditions of which this thing I think of as me is comprised a part. So we've still got space and consciousness, which are trickier, really. I mean, I love space. I love the space element because I think it's really interesting how, like, sitting here, you've all got about a foot between. No, you've got 2 inches, you two. You've got a bit of space between you and the next person, right? And probably if you came really close, you'd think, he or she's getting into my space. And in public spaces, like like maybe, you know, railway stations or whatever, our space gets quite small because we're bumping into people and we can cope with that. Here we probably want a bit more space. I actually like quite a lot. But then, like when you're in your car, I don't know if you've noticed, that your space gets really big and it actually extends beyond the car, like probably about a metre on either side, maybe a bit more, 2 metres, I don't know. And if another car comes too close, it's like, get out of my space. And like, still with the car, when you're looking for a parking space and you see your parking space, right, and then somebody else sees it too and it's like, no, that's my space. And it's like very quickly we own and identify with a particular space because we want it. It's like it suddenly becomes our space. And I think, you know, probably many of us are the same with our houses or our gardens or our bedrooms or our spaces, and we don't want anyone else in them, except with our permission, that's fine. But we think of them as ours. That's my space. So in this practice, we start to reflect on that, on this, you know, my space idea. So I might reflect, you might reflect, okay, right now, this is my space. This is where I'm sitting. This is the space my body's taking up, plus a couple of inches, it's my space. But actually, in a few minutes, it won't be my space. Oh, my space will be there, and there, and there, and there, and there, and, you know, so on. We're never in my space for long. In fact, there is no my space. And the spaces we're most attached to, like maybe our own bed or something, our own bedroom, our own garden, actually somebody else will be calling that their space before too long. There's no space that's my space for very long at all. I've been living in my house for 9 years or something. It's definitely my space. But, you know, before too long, someone else will have the same kind of sense of possessiveness around it, which is a bit scary too. It's kind of challenging when you get... I'm making light of it in a way, but it's pretty challenging when you think about the thing, the spaces you identify with, and the sense of possessiveness that you can have towards them. And that's kind of what we're doing in this practice. We're noticing our space and reminding ourselves it's not, there's no such thing as my space and all the other space, it's just space. And also we might reflect that the space that I think of as my space, the space my body is taking up, when I die, that space will no longer be my space. There'll be no space that's my space. You know, our space is gone when we die. It's kind of fun to think about, but it can be quite challenging to actually reflect on deeply. Consciousness, the last one. Again, this consciousness element is... nearly done, is described in different ways. For Bodhi Paksha, the way he talks about it is consciousness is everything that arises in terms of feelings, thoughts, images, emotions, sensations. They arise, they come into being, and they pass away. And what we realise when we reflect on this element, consciousness, is that we think my thoughts are my thoughts, we think my feelings are my feelings, and we start to realise that they just come and go. Actually, most of them aren't even in our control. They'll come and go when they want. You know, we decide not to think about a particular thing, and all we can do is think about a particular thing. And yet we call those thoughts my thoughts. So it's quite... it's quite freeing, actually, to just notice the arising and passing away of emotions, thoughts, images, ideas, all those things we think of as me and as being quite personal to me. And again, we think, well, this is not me, this is not mine, I am not this. This is the refrain that we sort of repeat throughout the practice. So we've worked through these six elements that are everything we know, really. Everything we know, everything we think of as mine, as in here or out there, is encompassed by these six elements. And ultimately, we let go of the sense of me and mine. I mean, that won't happen in a day or a week or a month or maybe even a lifetime of practice, but that is where the practice is leading, leading towards letting go of this false or illusory sense of a separate self, a separate body, a separate psychophysical organism. And just to finish, I'll just stress that these reflection practices, we don't do them just because they're fun, although they can be, or just because we're interested. We do them because they lead to happiness, in fact. As I said at the start, that's why the Buddha taught these practices. He didn't teach them so that we could be more mindful or be more full of loving kindness or be more compassionate. He taught them because they lead to freedom, really. They lead to happiness isn't even the right word, but awakening, which is the most profound happiness there is. They're not about making our lives better, they're about deeply transforming us. And I think that's, I just want to emphasise that, because Buddhism is kind of seen as, can be seen as a set of tools and strategies and techniques to lead a happier life, but actually that's just so undervaluing what the Buddha's teachings actually are. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say. I guess if there's any questions, I'm happy to take them, and then we'll have quite a short tea break, like just 10 minutes, and then go and do a practice.